difference. Uwe had made up his mind, and now he was fixed on it. He was going to drive his car until either he or it broke down. Either way, proper cars were not being made any more, he'd decided. There was only a lot of electronics and crap inside them now, like driving a computer. You couldn't even take them apart without the manufacturers whining about invalid guarantees. So it was just as well. Sonia said once that the car would break down with sorrow the day Uwe was buried. And maybe that was true. But there was a time for everything, she also said. Often. For example, when the doctors gave her the diagnosis 4 years ago. She found it easier to forgive than Uwe did. Forgive God and the universe and everything. Uwe got angry instead. Maybe because he felt someone had to be angry on her behalf, when everything that was evil seemed to assail the only person he'd ever met who didn't deserve it. So he fought the whole world. He fought with hospital personnel, and he fought with specialists and chief physicians. He fought with men in white shirts and the council representatives, who in the end grew so numerous that he could barely remember their names. There was an insurance policy for this, another insurance policy for that. There was one contact person because Sonia was ill, and another because she was in a wheelchair. Then a third contact person, so she did not have to go to work, and a fourth contact person to try and persuade the bloody authorities that this was precisely what she wanted, to go to work. And it was impossible to fight men in white shirts. And one could not fight a diagnosis. Sonia had cancer. We have to take it as it comes, said Sonia. And that was what they did. She carried on working with her darling troublemakers for as long as she could, until Uwe had to push her into the classroom every morning because she no longer had the strength to do it herself. After a year, she was down to 75% of her full working week. After 2 years, she was on 50%. After 3 years, she was on 25%. When she finally had to go home, she wrote a long personal letter to each of her students and exhorted them to call her if they ever needed anyone to talk to. Almost everyone did call. They came to visit, in long lines. One weekend, there were so many of them in the terraced house that Uwe had to go outside and sit in his tool shed for 6 hours. When the last of them had left that evening, he went round the house carefully assuring himself that nothing had been stolen, as usual. Until Sonia called out to him not to forget to count the eggs in the fridge. Then he gave up. Carried her up the stairs while she laughed at him. He put her in the bed and then, just before they went to sleep, she turned to him, hid her finger in the palm of his hand, burrowed her nose under his collarbone. God took a child from me, darling Uwe. But he gave me 1,000 others. In the 4th year, she died. Now he stands there, running his hand over her gravestone, again and again, as if he's trying to rub her back to life. I'm really going to do it this time. I know you don't like it. I don't like it either, he says in a low voice. He takes a deep breath, as if he has to steel himself against her trying to convince him not to do it. See you tomorrow, he says firmly, and stamps the snow off his shoes, as if not wanting to give her a chance to protest. Then he takes the little path down to the parking area, with the cat padding along beside him. Out through the black gates, round the Saab, which still has the learner plate stuck to the back door. He opens the passenger door. Pavana looks at him, her big brown eyes filled with empathy. I've been thinking about something, she says carefully, as she puts the Saab into gear and pulls off. Don't. But she can't be stopped. I was just thinking that maybe I could help you clean out the house, maybe put Sonia's things in boxes and... She hardly has time to speak Sonia's name before Uwe's face darkens, anger stiffening it into a mask. Not another word, he roars with a booming sound inside the car. But I was only thinking, not another bloody word! Have you got it? Pavana nods and goes silent. Shaking with anger, Uwe stares out of the window, all the way home. Chapter 31. A man called Uwe reverses with a trailer. again. The next morning after letting the cat out, he fetches Sonia's father's old rifle from the attic. He's decided that his dislike of weapons could never be greater than his dislike of all the empty places she has left behind in their silent little house. It is time now. But it seems that someone, somewhere, knows the only way of stopping him is to put something in his way that makes him angry enough not to do it. For this reason, he stands now in the little road between the houses, his arms defiantly crossed, looking at the man in the white shirt and saying, "I am here because there was nothing good on the TV." The man in the white shirt has been observing him without the slightest hint of emotion through the entire conversation. In fact, whenever Uwe has met him, he has been more like a machine than a person, just like all the other white shirts Uwe has run into in his life. The ones that said Sonia was going to die after the coach accident. The ones that refused to take their responsibility afterwards. And the ones who refused to hold others responsible. The ones who would not build a mobility ramp at the school. The ones who did not want to let her work. The ones that went through paragraphs of small print to root out some clause, meaning they wouldn't have to pay out any insurance money. The ones who wanted to put her in a home. They had all had the same empty eyes, as if they were nothing but shiny shells, walking round, grinding away at normal people and pulling their lives to pieces. But when Uwe says that thing about there being nothing good on the TV, he sees a little twitch at the temple of the white shirt. A flash of frustration, perhaps? Amazed anger, possibly? Pure disdain, very likely. It's the first time Uwe has noticed that he's managed to get under the skin of the white shirt, of any white shirt at all. The man snaps his jaws shut, turns round, and starts to walk away. Not with the measured, objective steps of a council employee in full control, but something else, with anger, impatience, vengefully. Uwe can't remember anything having made him feel so good in a long, long time. Of course, he was supposed to have died today. He had been planning to calmly and peacefully shoot himself in the head just after breakfast. He tidied the kitchen and let the cat out and made himself comfortable in his favourite armchair. He'd planned it this way because the cat routinely asked to be let out at this time. One of the few traits of the cat that Uwe was highly appreciative of was its reluctance to crap in other people's homes. Uwe was a man of the same ilk. But then, of course, Bavana came banging on his door as if it was the last functioning toilet in the civilized world, as if that woman had nowhere to wee at home. Uwe put the rifle away behind the radiator so she wouldn't see it and start interfering. He opened the door, and she more or less had to press her telephone into his hand by violent means before he accepted it. "What is this?" Uwe wanted to know, the telephone held between his index finger and his thumb as if it smelled bad. "It's for you," groaned Pavana, holding her stomach and mopping sweat from her forehead, even though it was minus degrees outside. "That journalist."
"What do I want with her telephone?"
"God, it's not her telephone, it's my telephone. She's on the line," Pavana said impatiently. Then, before he could protest, she squeezed past him and headed for his toilet.
"Yes?"
said Uwe, lifting the telephone to within a few centimetres of his ear, slightly unclear about whether he was still talking to Pavana or the person at the other end.
"Hi!"
yelled the journalist woman, Lena. Uwe felt it might be wise to move the phone further away from his ear.
"So are you ready to give me an interview now?"
she went on in a gung-ho tone.
"No,"
said Uwe, holding the telephone in front of him to work out how to hang up.
"Did you read the letter I sent you, or the newspaper? Have you read the newspaper? I thought I'd let you see it so you can form an impression of our journalistic style."
Uwe went into the kitchen, picked up the newspaper and letter that Adrian fellow had brought over a few days earlier.
"Have you got it?"
roared the journalist woman.
"Calm yourself down, I'm reading it, aren't I?"
Uwe said out loud to the telephone and leaned over the kitchen table.
"I was just wondering if," she continued valiantly. "Can you calm down, woman?"
Uwe raged. Suddenly, out the window, Uwe noticed a man in a white shirt in a Skoda driving past his house.
"Hello?"
the journalist woman called just before Uwe flew out of the front door.
"Oh, dear, dear,"
Pavana mumbled anxiously when she came out of the toilet and just about caught sight of him careering along between the houses. The man in the white shirt got out of the Skoda on the driver's side outside Runa and Anita's house.
"It's enough now. You hear? You're not driving your car inside the residential area. Not another bloody meter. You got it?"
shouted Uwe in the distance long before he'd even reached him. The little man in the white shirt, in a most superior manner, adjusted the cigarette packet in his breast pocket while calmly meeting Uwe's gaze.
"I have permission."
"Like hell you do."
The man in the white shirt shrugged, as if to chase away an irritating insect more than anything.
"And what exactly are you going to do about it, Uwe?"
The question actually caught Uwe off balance. Again. He stopped, his hands trembling with anger, at least a dozen pieces of invective at his disposal. But to his own surprise, he could not bring himself to use any of them.
"I know who you are, Uwe. I know everything about all the letters you've written about your wife's accident and your wife's illness.
You're something of a legend in our offices, you should know," said the man in the white shirt, his voice quite unwavering.
Uwe's mouth opened into a crack. The man in the white shirt nodded at him.
"I know who you are, and I'm only doing my job. A decision is a decision. You can't do anything about it. You should have learned that by now."
Uwe took a step towards him, but the man put up a hand against his chest and pressed him back. Not violently, not aggressively, just softly and firmly, as if the hand did not belong to him but was directly controlled by some robot at the computer center of a municipal authority.
"Go and watch some telly instead before you have more problems with that heart of yours."
On the passenger side of the Skoda, the determined woman, wearing an identical white shirt, stepped out with a pile of paper in her arms. The man locked the car with a loud bleep. Then he turned his back on Uwe, as if Uwe had never stood there talking to him. Uwe stayed where he was, his fists clenched at his sides and his chin jutting out as if he were an outraged bull elk. The white shirts disappeared into Anita and Runa's house. It took a minute before he recovered himself enough to even turn round. But then he did so with determined fury and started walking towards Pavana's house. Pavana was standing halfway up the little road.
"Is that useless husband of yours at home?" Uwe growled, walking past her without waiting for an answer.
Pavana didn't have time to do more than nod before Uwe, in four long strides, reached their front door. Patrick opened it, standing there on crutches, plaster apparently covering half of his body.
"Hi, Uwe,"
he called out cheerfully, trying to wave with a crutch, with the immediate effect that he lost his balance and stumbled into the wall.
"That trailer you had when you moved in, where did you get it?" Uwe demanded.
Patrick leaned with his functioning arm against the wall, almost as if he wanted it to look as if he'd meant to stumble into it.
"What? Oh, that trailer. I borrowed it off a guy at work."
"Call him. You need to borrow it again." And this was the reason why Uwe did not die today. Because he was detained by something that made him sufficiently angry to hold his attention. When the man and woman in the white shirts come out of Anita and Runa's house almost an hour later, they find that their little white car with the council logo has been boxed into the little cul-de-sac by a large trailer, a trailer which someone, while they were inside the house, must have parked exactly so it blocks the entire road behind them. One could almost think it had been done on purpose. The woman looks genuinely puzzled, but the man in the white shirt immediately walks up to Uwe.
"Have you done this?"
Uwe crosses his arms and looks at him coldly.
"No."
The man in the white shirt smiles in a superior manner, the way men in white shirts who are always used to having things their own way smile when someone tries to disagree with them. "Move it at once."
"I don't think so," says Uwe.
The man in the white shirt sighs, as if the threatening statement he makes after that was directed at a child.
"Move the trailer, Uwe, or I'll call the police."
Uwe shakes his head nonchalantly, pointing at the sign further down the road.
Motor vehicles prohibited inside the residential area. It says so clearly on the sign.
Don't you have anything better to do than standing out here pretending to be the foreman? Groans the man in the white shirt.
There was nothing good on TV, says Uwe.
And that's when there's a little twitch at the temple of the man in the white shirt, as if his mask has slipped a little, just a fraction. He looks at the trailer, his box-in Skoda, the sign, Uwe standing in front of him with his arms crossed.
The man seems to consider for an instant whether he might try to force Uwe by violence, but he realizes in another instant that this would very likely be an extremely bad idea.
This was very silly of you, Uwe. This was very, very silly, he hisses, finally.
And his blue eyes, for the first time, are filled with genuine fury. Uwe's face does not betray the slightest emotion. The man in the white shirt walks away, up towards the garages and the main road, with the sort of steps that make it clear that this will not be the end of this story. The woman with the papers hurries off after him. One might have expected Uwe to watch them with a look of triumph in his eyes. He would probably have expected this himself, in fact. But instead, he just looks sad and tired, as if he hasn't slept in months, as if he hardly has the strength to keep his arms up any longer. He lets his hands glide into his pockets and goes back home. But no sooner has he closed the door than someone starts banging on it again.
They're going to take Runa away from Anita, says Pavana urgently, snatching the front door open before Uwe has even reached the handle.
Huh, Uwe snorts tiredly. The resignation in his voice clearly takes both Pavana and Anita, who's standing behind her, by surprise. Maybe it also surprises Uwe. He inhales quickly through his nose, looks at Anita. She's greyer and more sunken than ever. Her eyes are red, swollen.
They say they'll come and pick him up this week, and that I can't manage to take care of him myself, she says in a voice so fragile that it hardly manages to get past her lips.
We have to do something, cries Pavana, grabbing him.
Uwe snatches his arm back and avoids her eyes.
Pah! They won't come to get him for years and years. This'll go to appeal, and then it'll go through all the bureaucratic shit, says Uwe.
He tries to sound more convinced and sure of himself than he actually feels, but he doesn't have the strength to care about how he's coming across. He just wants them to leave.
You don't know what you're talking about, roars Pavana.
You're the one who doesn't know what you're talking about. You've never had anything to do with the county council. You don't know what it's like fighting them, he answers in a monotone voice, his shoulders slumped.
But you have to talk,
she begins to say in a faltering voice. It's as if all the energy in Uwe's body is draining out of him even as he stands there. Maybe it's the sight of Anita's worn-out face. Maybe it's the insight that a simple battle won is nothing in the greater scheme of things. A boxed-in Skoda makes no difference. They always come back, just like they did with Sonia, like they always do, with their clauses and documents. Men in white shirts always win, and men like Uwe always lose people, like Sonia, and nothing can bring her back to him. In the end, there is nothing left but a long series of weekdays with nothing more meaningful than oiling the kitchen counters. And Uwe can't cope with it anymore. He feels it in that moment more clearly than ever. He can't fight anymore. Doesn't want to fight anymore. Just wants it all to stop. Pavana keeps trying to argue with him, but he just closes the door. She hammers at it, but he doesn't listen. He sinks down on the stool in the hall and feels his hands trembling. His heart thumps so hard that it feels like his ears are about to explode, the pressure on his chest, as if an enormous darkness has put its boot over his throat, doesn't begin to release till more than 20 minutes later. And then Uwe starts to cry.
Chapter 32. A man called Uwe isn't running a damned hotel. Sonia said once that to understand men like Uwe and Runa,
one had to understand from the very beginning that they were men caught in the wrong time. Men who only required a few simple things from life, she said. A roof over their heads, a quiet street, the right make of car, and a woman to be faithful to. A job where you had a proper function, a house where things broke at regular intervals so you always had something to tinker with. All people want to live dignified lives. Dignity just means something different to different people, Sonia had said. To men like Uwe and Runa, dignity was simply that they'd had to manage on their own when they grew up, and therefore saw it as their right not to become reliant on others when they were adults. There was a sense of pride in having control, in being right, in knowing what road to take and how to screw in a screw or not. Men like Uwe and Runa were from a generation in which one was what one did, not what one talked about. She knew, of course, that Uwe didn't know how to bear his nameless anger. He needed labels to put on it, ways of categorizing. So when men in white shirts at the council, whose names no normal person could keep a track of, tried to do everything Sonia did not want, make her stop working, move her out of her house, imply that she was worth less than a healthy person who was able to walk, and assert that she was dying, Uwe fought them. With documents, and letters to newspapers, and appeals, right down to something as unremarkable as a mobility ramp at a school. He fought so doggedly for her against men in white shirts that in the end he began to hold them personally responsible for all that happened to her and to the child. And then she left him alone in a world where he no longer understood the language. Later that night, once Uwe and the cat have had their dinner and watched the TV for a while, he turns out the lamp in the living room and goes upstairs. The cat follows watchfully at his heels, as if sensing that he's going to do something it hasn't been informed about. It sits on the bedroom floor while Uwe gets undressed and looks as if it's trying to figure out a magic trick. Uwe goes to bed and lies still, while the bloody cat on Sonia's side of the bed takes more than an hour to go to sleep. Obviously, he does not go to such lengths because of some lingering sense of obligation to the cat. He just doesn't have the energy for a row. He can't be expected to explain the concept of life and death to an animal that can't even take care of its own fur. When the cat finally rolls onto its back on Sonia's pillow and starts snoring with an open mouth, Uwe sneaks out of bed as light-footedly as he can, goes down into the living room, gets out the rifle from the hiding place behind the radiator. He gets out 4 heavy-duty tarpaulins he's fetched in from the tool shed and hidden in the broom cupboard so the cat doesn't notice them. Starts taping them up on the walls in the hall. Uwe, after some consideration, has decided that this will probably be the best room for the deed because it has the smallest surface area. He's assuming that there's a good deal of splattering when one shoots oneself in the head, and he's loath to leave more of a mess behind than he has to. Sonia always hated it when he made a mess. He's wearing his going-out shoes and suit again. It's dirty and still smells of car exhaust, but it'll have to do. He weighs the rifle in his hands as if checking its center of gravity, as if this will play a decisive role in the future of the venture. He turns and twists it, tries to angle the barrel, almost as if intending to fold the weapon double. Not that Uwe knows very much about weapons, but one wants to know if it's a decent bit of kit one's got, more or less. And because Uwe supposes one can't test the quality of a rifle by kicking it, he decides it can be done by bending and pulling at it to see what happens. While he's doing this, it strikes him that it was probably a fairly bad idea to put on his best gear. Will be an awful lot of blood on the suit, Uwe imagines. Seems silly. So he puts down the rifle, goes into the living room, gets undressed, carefully folds up the suit and puts it neatly beside his going-out shoes. Then he gets out the letter with all the instructions for Pavana and writes, "Bury me in my suit," under the heading, "Funeral Arrangements," and puts the letter on top of the pile of clothes. He has already stated clearly and unmistakably that there should not be any fuss in other respects. No exaggerated ceremony and rubbish like that. Shove him in the ground next to Sonia, that's all. The spot has already been prepared and paid for, and Uwe has put cash in the envelope for the transport. So, Wearing nothing but his socks and underwear, Uwe goes back into the hall and picks up his rifle. He catches sight of his own body in the hall mirror. He hasn't seen himself in this way for probably 35 years. He's still quite muscular and robust, certainly in better shape than most men of his age. But something's happened to his skin that makes him look like he's melting, he notes. It looks terrible. It's very quiet in the house, in the whole neighbourhood, actually. Everyone's sleeping. And only then does Uwe realise that the cat will probably wake at the sound of the shot, will probably scare the living daylights out of the poor critter, Uwe admits. He thinks about this for a good while before he determinedly puts away the rifle and goes into the kitchen to turn on the radio. Not that he needs music to take his own life, and not that he likes the idea of the radio clicking its way through units of electricity when he's gone, but because if the cat wakes up from the bang, it may end up thinking that it's just a part of one of those modern pop songs the radio plays all the time these days. And then go back to sleep. That is Uwe's train of thought. There's no modern pop song on the radio, Uwe hears when he comes back into the hall and picks up the rifle again. It's the local news bulletin. So he stays where he is for a moment and listens. Not that it's so important to listen to the local news when you're about to shoot yourself in the head, but Uwe thinks there's no harm in keeping yourself updated. They talk about the weather, and the economy, and the traffic, and the importance of local property owners staying vigilant over the weekend because of a large number of burglary rings on the rampage all over town. Bloody hooligans, Uwe mutters, and grips the rifle a little more firmly when he hears that. From a purely objective point of view, the fact that Uwe was wielding a gun was something two other hooligans, Adrian and Mersad, would ideally have been aware of before they unconcernedly trotted up to Uwe's front door a few seconds later. They would then quite likely have understood that when Uwe heard their creaking steps in the snow, he would not immediately think to himself, "Guests, how nice!" but rather, "Well, I'll be damned!" And they'd probably also know that Uwe, wearing nothing but socks and underpants, with a 3/4-century-old hunting rifle in his hands, would kick the door open like an aging, half-naked suburban Rambo. And maybe then Adrian would not have screamed, in a high-pitched voice that went right through every window in the street, nor would he have turned round in panic and run into the tool shed, almost knocking himself unconscious. It takes a few confused cries and a good deal of tumult before Mersad has time to clarify his identity as that of a normal hooligan, not a burglar hooligan, and for Uwe to get to grips with what's happening. Before then, he has had time to wave his rifle at them, making Adrian scream like an air raid warning.
"Shh! You'll wake the bloody cat!"
Uwe hisses angrily, while Adrian reels backwards, a swelling large as a medium-sized pack of ravioli on his forehead.
"What in the name of God are you doing here?"
he raves, the gun still firmly fixed on them.
"It's the middle of the bloody night."
Mersad is holding a big bag in his hand, which he gently drops into the snow. Adrian impulsively holds his hands up as if he's about to be robbed and almost loses his balance and falls into the snow again.
"It was Adrian's idea," Mersad begins, looking down into the snow. "Mersad came out today, you know," Adrian blurts out.
"What?"
"He came out, you know, told everyone he was,"
says Adrian, but he seems slightly distracted, partly by the fact that a fuming old man in his underpants is pointing a gun at him, and partly because he is increasingly convinced that he sustained some sort of concussion injury. Mersad straightens up and nods at Uwe with more determination.
"I told my dad I'm gay."
Uwe's eyes grow slightly less threatening, but he doesn't lower his rifle.
"My dad hates gays. He always said he'd kill himself if he found out that any of his children were gay," Mersad goes on.
After a moment's silence, he adds,
"He didn't take it so well, you might say." "He throwed him out," Adrian interjects.
"Through," Uwe corrects. Mersad picks up his bag from the ground and nods anew at Uwe.
"This was a stupid idea. We shouldn't have disturbed..."
"Disturbed me with what?" Uwe cuts him short. Now he's standing here in his underpants in minus degrees, he might as well at least find out the reason why, it seems to him. Mossad takes a deep breath, as if he's physically shoving his pride down his throat.
Dad said I was sick, and not welcome under his roof with my unnatural ways, he says,
swallowing hard before he manages to spit out the word unnatural.
Because you're a bender, Uwe clarifies.
Mossad nods.
I don't have any relatives here in town. I was going to stay the night at Adrian's, but his mum's new boyfriend is staying.
He goes quiet. Looks like he's feeling very silly.
It was an idiotic idea,
he says in a low voice and makes a move to turn round and leave. Adrian, on the other hand, seems to be rediscovering a desire for discussion, and he stumbles eagerly through the snow towards Uwe.
What the hell, Uwe? You've got a load of space in there, so we thought maybe he could kip here tonight.
Here? This is not a damned hotel,
says Uwe, raising the rifle so that Adrian's chest collides right into the barrel. Adrian freezes. Mossad takes two quick steps forward through the snow and puts his hand on the rifle.
We had nowhere else to go. Sorry,
he says in a low voice while gently turning the barrel away from Adrian. Uwe looks like he's coming to his senses slightly. He lowers his weapon to the ground. When he almost imperceptibly takes a half step backwards into the hall, as if he's only now become aware of the cold that envelops his not-so-well-dressed body, he notices in the corner of his eye the photo of Sonia on the wall. The red dress. The coach trip in Spain when she was pregnant. He asked her so many times to take that bloody photo down, but she refused. Said it was a memory worth as much as any other. Obstinate woman. So this should have been the day Uwe finally died. Instead, it became the evening before the morning when he woke not only with a cat, but also a bent person living in his terraced house. Sonia would have liked it, most likely. She liked hotels. Chapter 33. A man called Uwe and an inspection tour that is not the usual. Sometimes it is difficult to explain why some men suddenly do the things they do. Sometimes, of course, it's because they know they'll do them sooner or later anyway, and so they may as well just do them now. And sometimes it's the pure opposite, because they realize they should have done them long ago. Uwe has probably known all along what he has to do, but all people at root are time optimists. We always think there's enough time to do things with other people, time to say things to them. And then something happens, and then we stand there holding on to words like, if. As he marches down the stairs the next morning, he stops in the hallway. It hasn't smelled like this in the house since Sonia died. Watchfully, he takes the last few steps down, lands on the parquet floor, and stands in the doorway of the kitchen, his body language that of a man who has just caught a thief red-handed.
Is that you who's been toasting bread?
Mossad nods, anxiously.
Yes, I hope that's okay. Sorry, I mean, is it?
Uwe notices that he's made coffee, too. The cat is on the floor eating tuna. Uwe nods, but doesn't answer the question.
Me and the cat have to go for a little walk around our road, he clarifies instead.
Can I come? Asks Mossad quickly.
Uwe looks at him a little, as if Mossad has stopped him in a pedestrianized arcade, dressed up as a pirate, and asked him to guess under which of the three teacups he's hidden the silver coin.
Maybe I can help,
Mossad continues eagerly. Uwe goes into the hall and shoves his feet into his clogs. It's a free country, he mutters as he opens the door and lets out the cat. Mossad interprets this as,
of course you can,
and quickly puts on his jacket and shoes and goes after Uwe.
Hey, guys!
Jimmy hollers as they reach the pavement. He turns up, puffing energetically behind Uwe in a fiercely green tracksuit that's so tight around his body that Uwe wonders at first if it's in fact a garment or a body painting.
Jimmy!
Says Jimmy, panting, and offering Mossad his hand. The cat looks as if it would like to rub itself lovingly against Jimmy's legs, but seems to change its mind, bearing in mind that the last time it did something similar, Jimmy ended up in hospital. Instead, it opts for the next best available thing and rolls about in the snow. Jimmy turns to Uwe.
I usually see you walking round about this time, so I was going to check with you if you're cool with me tagging along. I've decided to start exercising, you know.
He nods with such satisfaction that the fat under his chin sways between his shoulders like a mainsail in stormy conditions. Uwe looks highly dubious.
Do you usually get up at this time?
Shit, no, man. I haven't even gone to bed yet, he laughs.
And this is why a cat, an overweight allergy sufferer, a bent person, and a man called Uwe make the inspection round that morning. Mersad explains in brief that he and his father are not getting along and that he's temporarily staying with Uwe. Jimmy expresses disbelief that Uwe is up at this time every single morning.
Why did you have a fight with the old man then? Asks Jimmy.
That's none of your business, Uwe barks.
Mersad gives Uwe a grateful glance.
But serious man, you do this every morning, Jimmy asks cheerfully.
Yes, to check if there have been any burglaries.
For real? Are there a lot of burglaries round here?
There are never lots of burglaries before the first burglary, Uwe mutters, and heads off towards the guest parking.
The cat looks at Jimmy as if unimpressed by his fitness drive. Jimmy pouts and touches his stomach in the apparent belief that he's already lost some weight.
Did you hear about Runa then?
He calls out, hastening his steps into a half jog behind Uwe. Uwe doesn't answer.
Social services are coming to pick him up, you know, Jimmy explains once he's caught up.
Uwe opens his pad and starts noting down the registration plates of the cars. Jimmy evidently takes his silence as an invitation to keep talking.
You know, the long and short of it is, Anita applied for more home help. Runa is just screwed and she couldn't deal with it anymore. So then the social did some investigation and some bloke called and said they decided she couldn't handle it and they were going to put Runa in one of those institutions, you know. And then Anita said they could forget about it. She didn't even want home help anymore. But then that guy got really aggro and started getting totally uncool with her, going on about how she couldn't take the investigation back now and she was the one who had asked them to look into it. And now the investigation had made a decision, and that was all there was to it, you know? Doesn't matter what she says, because the social guy is just running his own race. Know what I mean?
Jimmy goes silent and nods at Mersad in the hope of getting some kind of reaction.
Uncool, Mersad declares, hesitantly.
Bloody uncool, nods Jimmy until his upper body shakes.
Uwe puts his pen and pad in the inside pocket of his jacket and steers his steps towards the bin room.
It'll take them forever to make those kinds of decisions. They say they're taking him now, but they won't pull their finger out for another year or two, he snorts.
Uwe knows how that damned bureaucracy works.
But the decision is made, man, says Jimmy and scratches his hair.
Just sodding appeal it. It'll take years, says Uwe grumpily as he strides past him.
Jimmy looks at him, as if trying to evaluate whether it's worth the exertion of following him.
But she has done. She's been writing letters and things for 2 years.
Uwe doesn't stop when he hears that, but he slows down. He hears Jimmy's heavy steps bearing down on him in the snow.
2 years? He asks, without turning round.
More or less, says Jimmy.
Uwe looks like he's counting the months in his head.
That's a lie.
Then Sonya would have known about it, he says, dismissively.
I wasn't allowed to say anything to Sonya. Anita didn't want me to, you know?
Jimmy goes silent, looks down at the snow. Uwe turns round, raises his eyebrows.
I know what?
Jimmy takes a deep breath.
She thought you had enough troubles of your own, he says in a low voice.
The silence that follows is so thick you could split it with an axe. Jimmy does not look up, and Uwe doesn't say anything. He goes inside the bin room, comes out, goes into the bicycle shed, comes out. The penny seems to have dropped. Jimmy's last words hang like a veil over his movements, and an unfathomable anger builds up inside Uwe, picking up speed like a tornado inside his chest. He tugs at doors with increasing violence, kicks the thresholds, and when Jimmy, in the end, mumbles something about, "Now it's all screwed, man, now they'll put Runa in a home, you know," Uwe slams the door so hard that the entire bin room shakes. He stands in silence with his back to them, panting more and more heavily.
"Are you okay?" asks Mersad.
Uwe turns round and points with anything but controlled fury at Jimmy.
"Was that how she put it? She didn't want to ask for Sonya's help because we had enough troubles of our own."
Jimmy nods anxiously. Uwe stares down at the snow, his chest heaving under his jacket. He thinks about how Sonya would have taken it if she'd found out, if she'd known that her best friend had not asked for her help because Sonya had enough problems. She would have been heartbroken. Sometimes it's hard to explain why some men suddenly do the things they do. And Uwe had probably known all along what he had to do, who he had to help before he could die. But we are always optimists when it comes to time. We think there will be time to do things with other people, and time to say things to them. Time to appeal. Again, Uwe turns to Jimmy with a grim expression.
2 years.
Jimmy nods. Uwe clears his throat. For the first time, he looks unsure.
"I thought she'd just started. I thought I had more time," he mumbled.
Jimmy looks as if he's trying to figure out who Uwe is talking to. Uwe looks up.
"And they're coming to get Runa now, seriously. No bureaucratic rot and appeals and all that shit. You're sure about this?"
Jimmy nods again. He opens his mouth to say something, but Uwe has already started moving off. He makes off between the houses with the movements of a man about to take his revenge for a deadly injustice in a western. Turns off at the house, by the bottom, where the trailer and the white Skoda are still parked, banging at the door with such force that it's difficult to tell whether it will open before he reduces it to wood chips. Anita opens in shock. Uwe steps right into her hall.
"Have you got the papers from the authorities here?"
"Yes, but I thought..."
"Give them to me."
In retrospect, Anita will tell the other neighbours that she had not seen Uwe so angry since 1977, when there was talk of a merger between Saab and Volvo. Chapter 34. A man called Uwe and a boy in the house next door. Uwe has brought along a blue plastic deck chair to push into the snow and sit on. This could take a while, he knows. It always does when he has to tell Sonya something she won't like. He carefully brushes away all the snow from the gravestone so they can see each other properly. In just short of 40 years, a lot of different kinds of people have had time to pass through their row of terraced houses. The house between Uwe's and Runa's has been lived in by quiet, loud, curious, unbearable, and hardly noticeable kinds of people. Families have lived there whose teenage children pissed on the fence when they were drunk, or families who tried to plant non-approved bushes in the garden, and families who got the idea that they wanted to paint their house pink. And if there was one single thing Uwe and Runa agreed on, irrespective of how much they were feuding at the time, it was that whoever currently populated the neighbour's house tended to be utter imbeciles. At the end of the 1980s, the house was bought by a man who was apparently some sort of bank manager, as an investment, Uwe heard him boast to the estate agent. He, in turn, rented the house to a series of tenants in the coming years. One summer, to 3 young men who made an audacious attempt to redefine it as a free zone for a veritable parade of drug addicts, prostitutes, and criminal elements. The parties went on around the clock. Broken glass from beer bottles covered the little walkway between the houses like confetti, and the music boomed out so loud that the pictures fell off the wall in Sonya and Uwe's living room. Uwe went over to put a stop to the nuisance, and the young men jeered at him. When he refused to go, one of them threatened him with a knife. When Sonia tried to make them see sense the following day, they called her a paralyzed old bag. The evening after, they played louder than ever, and when Anita, in pure desperation, stood outside and shouted at them, they threw a bottle that went right through her and Runa's living room window. And that was obviously quite a bad idea. Uwe immediately began working on his plans for revenge by examining the financial doings of their landlord. He called lawyers and the tax authorities to put a stop to the letting of the house, and he intended to persist with it, even if he had to take the case all the bloody way to the Supreme Court, as he put it to Sonia. But he never had time to get that idea off the ground. Late one night he saw Runa walking towards the parking area with his car keys in his hand. When he came back, he had a plastic bag, the contents of which Uwe could not determine, in his hand. And the following day, the police came and took away the three young men in handcuffs and charged them with possession of a large amount of drugs, which, after an anonymous tip-off, had been found in their shed. Uwe and Runa were both standing in the street when it happened. Their eyes met. Uwe scratched his chin.
"Me, I wouldn't even know where to buy narcotics in this town," said Uwe thoughtfully.
"In the street behind the train station," said Runa, with his hands in his pockets.
"At least that's what I've heard," he added, with a grin.
Uwe nodded. They stood smiling there in the silence for a long time.
"Car running well?" asked Uwe eventually.
"Like a Swiss watch," smiled Runa.
They were on good terms for 2 months after that. Then, of course, they fell out again over the heating system. But it was nice while it lasted, as Anita said. The tenants came and went in the following years, most with a surprising amount of forbearance and acceptance from Uwe and Runa. Perspective can make a great deal of difference to people's reputation. One summer, halfway through the 1990s, a woman moved in with a chubby boy of about 9, whom Sonia and Anita immediately took to their hearts. The boy's father had left them when the boy was newborn, Sonia and Anita were told. A bull-necked man of about 40 who lived with them now, and whose breath the two women tried to ignore for as long as possible, was her new love. He was rarely at home, and Anita and Sonia avoided asking too many questions. They supposed that the girl saw qualities in him that they perhaps did not understand.
"He has taken care of us, and you know how it is, it's not easy being a single mother," she said, with a brave smile at some point. And the women from the neighbouring houses left it at that.
The first time they heard the bull-necked man shouting through the walls, they decided that each and every one must be allowed to mind their own business in their home. The second time, they thought that all families row sometimes, and maybe this was nothing more serious than that. When the bull-necked man was away the next time, Sonia invited in the woman and the boy for coffee. The woman explained with a strained laugh that the bruises were because she'd thrown open a kitchen cabinet too quickly. In the evening, Runa met the bull-necked man in the parking area. He got out of his car in a clear state of intoxication. In the 2 nights that followed, the neighbouring houses on either side overheard how the man was shouting in there and things were being thrown at the floor. They heard the woman giving a short cry of pain, and when the sound of the weeping 9-year-old lad pleading with the man to stop came through the wall, Uwe went outside and stood in front of his house. Runa was already waiting. They were in the midst of one of their worst ever power struggles in the steering group of the Residents' Association, had not even spoken to each other for almost a year. Now they just briefly glanced at one another and then went back into their houses without a word. 2 minutes later they met fully dressed at the front. They rang the bell. The thug lashed out at them as soon as he opened the door, but Uwe's fist struck the bridge of his nose. The man lost his footing, got up, grabbed a kitchen knife and ran at Uwe. He never got there. Runa's massive fist slugged him like a mallet. In his heyday, he was quite a piece, that Runa. Highly unwise to get involved in fisticuffs with him. The next day, the man left the terrace and never came back. The young woman slept with Anita and Runa for 2 weeks before she dared go home again with her boy. Then Runa and Uwe went into town and went to the bank, and in the evening Sonia and Anita explained to the young woman that she could see it as a gift, or a loan, whichever she preferred, but it wasn't open for discussion. And so it was that the young woman stayed on in the house with her son, a chubby, computer-loving little boy, whose name was Jimmy. Now, Uwe leans forward and looks with great seriousness at the gravestone. I just thought I'd have more time somehow to do everything. She doesn't answer. I know how you feel about causing trouble, Sonia, but this time you have to understand. One can't reason with these people. He pokes his thumbnail into the palm of his hand. The gravestone stays where it is without saying anything, but Uwe doesn't need words to know what she would have thought. The silent approach has always been her preferred trick when there are disputes with him, whether she's alive or dead. In the morning, Uwe had called that social services authority or whatever the hell it was called. He'd called from Pavana's house because he no longer had a telephone line. Pavana had advised him to be friendly and approachable. It hadn't started so well, because before long Uwe had been connected to the responsible officer, which was the smoking man in the white shirt. He directly demonstrated a significant level of agitation about the little white Skoda, which was still parked at the bottom of the road outside Runa and Anita's house. And yes, Uwe could have established a better negotiating position if he'd immediately apologized about it, and maybe even agreed that it was regrettable that he'd intentionally put the man in the white shirt in this non-vehicular predicament. It would certainly have been better than the alternative, which was to hiss, "So maybe you've learned to read signs now, illiterate bastard!" Uwe's next move involved trying to convince the man that Runa should not be put in a home. The man informed Uwe that illiterate bastard was a very bad choice of words for bringing up that subject. After this, there was a long series of impolite phrases on both ends of the telephone line before Uwe declared in clear terms that things could not be allowed to work like this. One couldn't just come along and remove people from their homes and transport them to institutions any old way one liked, just because their sense of memory was getting a bit defective. The man at the other end answered coldly that it didn't matter very much where they put Runa now, in the state he was in, because for him it would probably make a very marginal difference where he was. Uwe roared a series of invectives back, and then the man in the white shirt said something very stupid. The decision has been made. The investigation has been going on for 2 years. There's nothing you can do, Uwe. Nothing at all. And then he hung up. Uwe looked at Pavana, looked at Patrick, slammed Pavana's mobile into their kitchen table and boomed that they needed a new plan immediately. Pavana looked deeply unhappy, but Patrick nodded at once, grabbed his crutches and hobbled quickly out the door, as if he'd just been waiting for Uwe to say that. 5 minutes later, to Uwe's deep dissatisfaction, he came back with that silly fop Anders from the neighbouring house, with Jimmy cheerfully tagging along. "What's he doing here?" said Uwe, pointing at the fop. "I thought you needed a plan," said Patrick, nodding at the fop and looking very pleased with himself. "Anders is our plan," Jimmy threw in. Anders looked around the hall a little awkwardly, apparently slightly dissuaded by Uwe's expression. But Patrick and Jimmy insistently pushed him into the living room. "Go on, tell him," Patrick prompted.
"Tell me what?"
"Okay, so I heard you had some problems with the owner of that Skoda, yeah?" began Anders, giving Patrick a nervous glance. Uwe nodded impatiently for him to continue. "Well, I don't think I've ever told you what sort of company I have I?" Anders went on tentatively. Uwe put his hands in his pockets, adopted a slightly more relaxed position. And then Anders told him. And even Uwe had to admit that it sounded almost more than decently opportune.
"Where are you keeping that blonde bimbo?" he started saying once Anders had finished, but he stopped himself when Pavana kicked his leg.
"Your girlfriend," he corrected himself.
"Oh."
"We split up. She moved out," said Anders and looked at his shoes. Whereupon he had to explain that apparently she'd become a bit upset about Uwe feuding so much with her and the dog, But her annoyance had been small beer compared to her agitation when Anders found out that Uwe called her dog Mutt and had not quite been able to stop himself smiling about it. And so it came to pass that when the chain-smoking man in the white shirt turned up in their road that afternoon, accompanied by a police officer, to demand that Uwe release the white Skoda from its captivity, both the trailer and the white Skoda were already gone. Uwe stood outside his house with his hands calmly tucked into his pockets, while his adversary finally lost his composure altogether and started roaring expletives at him. Uwe maintained that he had no idea how this had happened, but pointed out in a friendly manner that none of this would have happened in the first place if he'd just respected the sign that made it clear that cars were prohibited in the area. He obviously left out the detail that Anders owned a car towing company, and that one of his tow trucks had picked up the Skoda at lunchtime and then placed it in a large gravel pit 40 kilometres outside town. And when the police officer tactfully asked if he had really not seen anything, Uwe looked right into the eyes of the man in the white shirt and answered, "I don't know, I may have forgotten. You start losing your memory at my age." When the police looked around and then wondered why Uwe was standing about here in the street, if he had nothing to do with the disappearance of the Skoda, Uwe just innocently shrugged his shoulders and peered at the man in the white shirt. "There's still nothing good on the TV." Anger drained the man's face of colour until, if possible, his face was even whiter than his shirt. He stormed off, raging that this was far from over. And of course it wasn't. Only an hour or so later, Anita opened the door to a courier who gave her a recorded delivery letter from the council, signed, confirmed, with the time and date of the transfer into care. And now Uwe stands by Sonia's gravestone and manages to say something about how sorry he is. "You get so damned worked up when I fight with people, I know that. But the reality of it is this. You'll just have to wait a bit longer for me up there. I don't have time to die right now." Then he digs up the old frozen pink flowers out of the ground, plants the new ones, straightens up, folds up his deck chair, and walks towards the parking area whilst muttering something that sounds suspiciously like, "Because there's a bloody war on." Chapter 35. A Man Called Uwe and Social Incompetence. When Pavana, with panic in her eyes, runs right into Uwe's hall and continues into the toilet without even bothering to say good morning, Uwe immediately disputes how one can become so acutely in need of a pee in the space of the 20 seconds it takes her to walk from her own house to his. But hell has no fury like a pregnant woman in need, Sonia once informed him. So he keeps his mouth shut. The neighbours are saying he's been like a different person these last days, that they've never seen him so engaged before. But as Uwe irritably explains to them, that's only because Uwe has never bloody engaged himself in their particular business before. He's always been a bloody engaged person. Patrick says the way he walks between the houses and slams the doors the whole time is like a really angry avenging robot from the future. Uwe doesn't know what he means by that. But anyway, he spent hours at a time in the evenings sitting with Pavana and Patrick and the girls, while Patrick, to the best of his abilities, has tried to get Uwe not to put angry fingerprints all over Patrick's computer monitor whenever he wants to show them something. Jimmy, Mersad, Adrian and Anders have also been there. Jimmy has repeatedly tried to get everyone to call Pavana and Patrick's kitchen the Death Star and Uwe Darth Uwe. They've considered countless plans over the last few days, including planting marijuana in the white-shirted man's shed, as Runa might have suggested, but after a few nights, Uwe seems to give up. He nods grimly, demands to use the telephone, and shuffles off into the next room to make a call. He didn't like doing it, but when there's a war on, there's a war. Pavana comes out of the toilet. "Are you done?" Uwe wonders, as if he's suspecting this to be some sort of half-time interval. She nods, but just as they're on their way out of the door, she notices something in his living room and stops. Uwe is standing in the doorway, but he knows very well what she's staring at. It's
Oh, what the hell, it's nothing special, he mumbles and tries to wave her out of the door. When she fails to move, he gives the edge of the doorframe a hard kick.
It was only gathering dust. I sanded it down and repainted it and applied another layer of lacquer. That's all. It's no big bloody deal, he grumbles, irritated.
Oh, Uwe,
whispers Pavana. Uwe occupies himself checking the threshold with a couple of kicks.
We can rub it down and repaint it pink. If it's a girl, I mean, he mutters.
Clears his throat.
Or if it's a boy. Boys can have pink nowadays, can't they?
Pavana looks at the light blue cot, her hand across her mouth.
If you start crying now, you're not having it, warns Uwe.
And when she starts crying anyway, Uwe sighs. Bloody women. And turns round and starts walking down the road. The man in the white shirt extinguishes his cigarette under his shoe and bangs on Anita and Runa's door about half an hour later. He's brought along three young men in nurse uniforms, as if he's expecting violent resistance. When frail little Anita opens the door, the three young men look a touch ashamed of themselves more than anything. But the man in the white shirt takes a step towards her and waves his document in the air, as if holding an axe in his hands.
It's time, he informs her with a certain impatience, and tries to step into the hall.
But she places herself in his way, as much as a person of her size can place herself in anyone's way.
No,
she says, without budging an inch. The man in the white shirt stops and looks at her, shakes his head.